The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk coming up.
Their Nazi lie was completely invented and had no justification.
Achtung, baby. Max Mosley wins his privacy case, so what now for tabloid sex scandals and the career of News of the Screws boss Colin Myler?
All round, the editor has not been taking a hands-on view of an amazingly scandalous, sensational story. That is a bad admission by a tabloid editor.
Also in the podcast, as the BBC announces Rowley Keating as its first Director of Archive Content, we'll report on the race to replace him at the top of BBC Two. And
I have to tell you something. When you came on, you said it was a pleasure to meet us all. I have to tell you, the pleasure is all yours.
Duncan Ballantyne and co are back, just as charming as ever. We'll review the new series of Dragon's Den and the best and worst of the rest of the week's TV. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, last week's show was described as the most boring Media Talk ever by one listener on our Organ Grinder blog, which was, of course, music to the ears of our holidaying producer, Ben Green, back behind the glass this week. Let's see if... I should say, of course, that later posters said it was actually not as boring as that. Let's see if this week's panel can do any better. Joining me in the pod this week is media analyst and managing director of Kidsco TV, Paul Robinson. I don't know, perhaps we should give away, you know, copy of The Sun and give away tickets to the Royal Opera House as a sort of an incentive.
Fantastic, yes.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what opera Media Talk listeners would fancy going to, though.
I'd like to go to the Royal Festival Hall to The Wizard of Oz.
Right, we'll do that. OK. Now, perhaps a little surprisingly, Steve Hewlett, a Media Guardian columnist par excellence and soon-to-be presenter of Radio 4's brand new media show, is also here. Does Mark Damaser know where you are, Steve?
I'm not sure that he does. I won't be swearing anymore.
OK. I'm sure he's not listening anyway. Right, let's get
He's also got the look over the glasses, the Jenny Murray look
right,
over the glasses,
has,
the Radio 4 look, yes.
He's cultivated.
If you're very lucky,
definitely.
If you're very lucky, I'll put on my telephone voice.
Okay, John, sure. Your Radio 4 voice. Okay, yeah. let's get going.
Right, well, I'd like to say that I'm delighted with that judgment, which is devastating for the News of the World. It demonstrates that their Nazi lie was completely invented and had no justification. It also shows that they had no right to go into private premises and take pictures and films of adults engaged in activities which are no one's business but those of the people concerned.
Yes, it's the news that Max Mosley has won his High Court privacy case against the News of the World. The tabloid had alleged that the Formula One boss had taken part in a, quote, sick Nazi orgy. But whilst acknowledging there was a fair amount of bondage, beating and domination going on, Mr. Justice Eady said there was no evidence of Nazi behaviour. And he therefore awarded Mosley £60,000 in damages, saying that his life had been ruined. That's rather overstating it, I thought, but never mind. Anyway, that's what he said. He also said there was no public interest justification for the News of the World secretly filming Mosley in a Chelsea dungeon and then posting the video on its website. It brings to an end one of the most high-profile tabloid legal cases of recent times, and it might just prove to be a watershed moment when it comes to sexual exposés in the papers. Now, Roy Greenstade is the Professor of Journalism at City University and the Media Guardian press blogger. I spoke to him earlier to get his reaction.
I'm not at all surprised. I think that the moment that the News of the World admitted in court that they'd not bothered to have the German dialogue translated, and then the loss of their star witness, Woman E, these were terrific turning points. I was actually surprised that Mr. Justice Eady, the judge, didn't call a halt to proceedings the moment that the NOW couldn't produce their key witness, because at that point its defence collapsed.
Well, it's quite interesting because the judge has pretty much said that the sexual peccadilloes of Max Mosley and indeed, by implication, anyone else are not fair game for newspapers. So it's a pretty significant ruling for tabloid journalism, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, I think that, by the way, I absolutely support that. I've always taken the view that whatever consenting adults get up to, and I hark back here to the famous or infamous Spanner trial, whatever they get up to, if they're consenting, then they should be allowed to do it, and they should be allowed to do it in private. And I think the judge has backed that up pretty well. But it is significant because newspapers regularly, especially the News of the World, publish scandalous stuff, particularly about footballers and models, which really have no public interest beyond the sexual tittle-tattle. So it'll be interesting to see whether celebrities who find themselves in these papers will now sue using this as a precedent.
The other argument is that, celebrities aside, that it will have a chilling effect on responsible investigative journalism. What do you make of that?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's completely nonsensical. I mean, what Edie has done, as he has done in previous libel trials, is say that, or state that, most importantly, that public interest remains the justification for doing something. So if a responsible newspaper is going about its business and needs to intrude into the privacy of somebody because that is in the public interest, then they can do so. And I don't think that inhibits press freedom. Of course, there is one rider to that, Matt, and that is that if, for any reason, a public figure got to hear that a newspaper was investigating, could they then use prior restraint through an injunction to prevent further investigation? Now, that would be an interesting test case, but at the moment, I think that press freedom remains pretty inviolable as far as the judge is concerned and as far as public interest is concerned.
Wouldn't it be better to have a privacy law that's codified by Parliament rather than codified by Mr. Justice Edie in the High Court in London?
Well, Parliament's always flunked a privacy law, so just as we forecast at the time when we incorporated the European Commission of Human Rights into our law, it's come in through the back door, and when it comes in through the back door, it's natural, it's going to be judge-made law. Whether it's worse or whether it's better, I don't really think, I think it's a moot point. To be honest with you, I think Parliament will still flunk this one, and they'll let the judges get on with it, as long as the judges are as sensible enough not to prevent journalists from going about their proper job, which is holding power to account, then I don't think we've got anything to worry about.
Talking about journalists doing their job, what about the jobs of the journalists involved here, particularly the editor of the News of the World, Colin Myler, who's been, if you'll forgive the expression, spanked a few times by the courts now, hasn't he?
Yes, well, Mr. Myler has a poor track record, and I think this is a further example of his poor judgment. He should, in these circumstances, just as his predecessor did when he got things wrong, he needs to think about resigning. I doubt that that will happen, but it is pretty poor when an editor admits, firstly, that he didn't see the full video, which was an astonishing admission in court. Secondly, that he seems surprised that the reporter hadn't obtained a written consent from Woman E, the main witness, before he went to press. That's an astonishing thing for an editor to admit. And then, of course, the admission that there had been no translation from the German. You know, all round, the editor has not been taking a hands-on view of an amazingly scandalous, sensational story. That is a bad admission by a tabloid editor.
Well, I've got... That was Roy Greenslade there, by the way. I've got the full ruling and judgment here. It's very funny. Can I read my favourite bit?
Yes,
to,
please.
Paul and Steve. There's a section, subsection 53, yeah, paragraph 53. Do you remember there was a whole bit about, in the case, that related to whether it turned on whether it was a Nazi theme and whether they were at concentration camps, and one of the issues was having their heads inspected for lice and their bodies shaved, right? So it says here in the ruling, Mr. Thirlbeck, that's the News of the World reporter, also relied upon the fact that the claimant, Max Mosley, was, quote, shaved. Concentration camp inmates were also shaved. Yet, as Mr. Price pointed out, they had their heads shaved. The claimant, for reasons best known to himself, enjoyed having his bottom shaved, apparently for its own sake, rather than because of any supposed Nazi connotation. So there we are. You see, it's fine to have your bottom shaved. No Nazi connotations to that at all.
Waxing every time.
Absolutely. But this is, I mean, I suppose, joking aside, I mean, this is the point, isn't it? Is that, you know, there's so much salacious detail in it, and of course we won't go into any more of it because we're The Guardian and we don't do that sort of thing, Steve. But there are...
Well, not in the paper, anyway.
Maybe later, sorry. Perhaps. But there is a serious issue here in that in order to bring this action, Max Mosley has had to undergo further humiliation in the courts.
Yes, I mean, that's true, and I would agree with Roy Greenslade, you know, that And interestingly, by the way, coming from a broadcasting background, the BBC producer guidelines would never have allowed this show to get off. I mean, first of all, the BBC wouldn't have done this in any event.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting that in the BBC and in the terms of the ITC and Ofcom guidelines for producers at Channel 4 and commercial broadcasters, the basic test for an invasion of privacy has always been to hold the invasion of privacy up against the public interest. And that's always been the test. And however it's written, that's always been really, really, really strictly applied.
And do you think that there, Paul, that there's an issue here that the News of the World had a point in saying that Max Mosley is a public figure because he's the boss of Formula One, and if there were Nazi implications here, that because of who his father was, then they had a right to go as far as they went? Or do you just think that the problem was is that the evidence didn't stack up?
No, I think he's a public figure, and therefore he has to be aware that certain standards are required, and there's a certain accountability that goes with that position. So clearly, if he was engaged in Nazi activity, I think that is a public interest. The fact he's engaged in some sort of sexual activity, totally his own business.
Striped pyjamas, it says here in paragraph 58, may loosely suggest prison uniform, but yet again there is nothing to identify the clothing as of the Nazi era. I mean,
look, we're all wearing stripes. We're hardly...
But not pyjamas, and not bottoms.
Don't wish to know, thank you.
No. But, I mean, I still think that there must be a question over what happened at the News of the World when they were sitting down to consider what the material they'd got. Let's assume the best for a second, the best of motivation, in the sense that they're tipped off, they think, that they've reason to think, prima facie, that there might be sort of, you know, Nazi goings on, so on and so on and so on, and that would be a matter of public interest, I agree, and so on and so on and so on. So they do it, they set the thing up, they look at it, and... Now, at that point, you surely have to have a proper sit-down session to say, well, was it or wasn't it? And Justice Eadie's had a proper sit-down session, albeit in the public court.
He seems very well informed on all this.
He does.
Well, that's the glory of Britain's judiciary, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You would expect it to be well informed about some things, and perhaps S&M is one of them.
Well, I don't know about that. We're not casting any suspersions. We're not allowed to cast aspersions on Mr. Mosley, certainly not on Mr. Justice Eadie.
Heavens.
But heaven forfend. Steve, what about the position of Colin Myler, the editor of the News of the World? He was quite forthright when he stood on the steps of the court, said he wasn't going to consider resignation or anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite. He said that it was the News of the World that had been the victim, that they'd been dragged through the courts, and this was a shaming episode. Do you think his position is secure?
Well, I doubt it. I mean, in the sense that Rupert Murdoch is... actually, for all that is often said about him, in terms of the ethics of his editors, I have to say he's no slouch. He's quite hot on these things. And this story was wrong. If they'd sat down and looked at the material, as Roy pointed out, you know, if they'd sat down and looked at the material they'd got, if they'd bothered translating the German into English, they should have known that this was not a Nazi event.
Part of the problem, I think, was just equating German with Nazi, which in itself shows.
You can't put that into the public. You can't go public with that and not expect to get sued. I mean, that's absurd.
Well, exactly. But, well, that's my point. Just equate it.
If I was the proprietor and he was running my newspaper, that would at the very least suggest to me that he wasn't across what was in any event going to be a very big, very public, very controversial story, which could easily land us in court and damage reputation, da-da-da-da-da. Now, one of the things that the tabloids in Britain, they're often accused of bad journalism, and actually, quite often, leaving aside their ethical standards in terms of invasions of privacy and all the rest of it, quite often, I think, generally speaking, the reverse has been true. Actually, their journalism, in terms of what happened, who said what to who, is often, not always, is often really quite sharp. The News of the World has only survived because its journalism, at some level, most of its journalism has been pretty solid in that sense. I don't mean it, maybe not nice, but it's been pretty solid. Mm. If I was the proprietor and he'd just done this to me, I would say, of course, his position's under threat.
Final question to Paul Robinson. What do you think Max will spend his 60 grand on, charity or drugs and hookers?
Oh, the latter would be sensible.
Okay, well, hopefully this is... That
well, it's nearly Friday night, come on.
Well, hopefully...
This is a weekend thing.
I'm going to do my German accent.
Sorry.
Okay?
All right, we're looking forward to it.
Hopefully that is the end of the matter, once and for all. You can read plenty... That wasn't a very good German accent, was it? You can read plenty more analysis about the Max Mosley trial at mediaguardian.co.uk. I'm Matt Wells. You're listening to Media Talk. Still to come, Gareth McLean will be here to talk lesbians, dragons, cops and robbers. And...
Hello there, CT here with a polite reminder to cancel your summer holiday, turn down your neighbour's wedding and get ready for my new radio show.
The Chris Tarrant Show, sponsored by Nissan Micra.
We look ahead to Chris Tarrant's return to the airwaves and the American Style sponsorship deal that's made it all possible. But first, time to talk television, and this week the BBC announced that Rowley Keating will be stepping down from his position as the controller of BBC Two in the autumn. He is going to take up a new position as the director of the BBC's archive content. So basically, Steve, he's going to be in charge of old stuff.
Actually, the acronym would be DOAC.
That's right. Or Dark or something, isn't it?
DOAC. D-O-A-C. Okay.
Director of Archive Content.
Well, look, no, I think the job he's moving to is, for the BBC, for the future, it's a very, very important role. Because, okay, you know, a major part of the BBC's proposition in the next 5 years is going to be opening up that archive. So, absolutely.
But is that ever going to happen? Because, I mean, Greg Dyke used to talk about this. I remember being at a press conference where he, with great fanfare, announced that the archive is going to be...
Look, there are lots of issues about this. But, first of all, the technology is nearly there to enable it to happen in ways that were almost not imaginable when Greg Dyke was DG. We've now got iPlayer. We're about to get Kangaroo. But anyway, so that's one thing. The second thing is this. When they launched the last annual report, the chairman was at pains to point out, when asked, that one of the issues about BBC Worldwide were what he described as the boundaries around which it operated. Forgive me if that sounds like a diversion. One of the arguments against releasing the archive, or making more free public use of the archive, is that it would damage commercial revenues. So right. The BBC Worldwide bit of the organisation's brain was continually saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. There's money in them, their archives, don't let them out. There's another bit which says, hang on a second, you know, actually, surely the BBC should be leading the way in terms of letting licence payers gain full and free access, as long as it's for non-commercial purposes, to this huge archive of content that they have essentially paid for the creation of. So I think this is a genuinely serious, and I think...
So it's not a non-job, he's not been shunted off because BBC Two's not doing very well?
BBC Two's doing fine. The problem with BBC Two is that it had its personality, you know, not before Rowley got there, it had its personality surgically removed. It had half its brain given to BBC Three, that's the comedy bit, and the other half of its brain, that's the high culture and proper serious factual stuff, given to BBC Four. So what is BBC Two? Actually, some great programmes, but in a multi-channel environment, the problem with BBC Two is, what is it?
So this will be the challenge, Paul Robinson, for Rowley Keating's successor, to reinvent BBC Two, won't it? Who do you think would be the best person for the job?
Well, I mean, Janice Hadlow's the name everyone's talking about. It does need someone, I think, though, who's got a little bit more sort of personality, yeah, and a bit more drive. I mean, yeah, Rowley is a great guy.
Janice Hadlow, you and I may know who she is, but she's not exactly the most famous person.
No, she's not. But she has got a point of view. I think Rowley is one of the few people I could imagine actually saying, I'm genuinely excited about the archive. What I'm saying? I mean, it does sort of send you feel like you're going into your sort of your dotage. But no, they need someone who's going to actually, as Steve says, give BBC Two a personality. Having had that left and right brain removed, as you say, you know, it does need some new oomph. I think the other point about this is this does actually self-serve the BBC, because if you think about the amount of money the BBC makes out of Worldwide and the amount of money it gets from the licence fee, actually, if you can underpin the licence fee by making licence fee payers stronger advocates for the licence fee by giving them all this free stuff, that's a far stronger strategy to maintain the BBC going forward than actually propping up Worldwide.
And I don't doubt for a second that uppermost in the BBC's marketing brain is that re-establishing or reinforcing that connection between the audience, not in the programmes, because they like them, but the audience and the emotional connection with the organisation. Look at those adverts for the Today programme on BBC One. It's almost saying to you, imagine what life would be like without the Today programme.
Yes.
I absolutely agree with that. The other commercial point, though, is not so much about the BBC. It's more about non-BBC players. And the big issue with the iPlayer, of course, is it's BBC proprietary. You know, so you can't get onto the iPlayer unless you're BBC. And that's where the BBC does risk distorting the market.
Well, if they took Janice Hadlow, who's the controller of BBC Four at the moment, that would be an inside job, or it would be in expected moves. What about doing something unexpected? Somebody like Peter Barron, the editor of Newsnight, he's been mentioned, or indeed do a Tim Davey and appoint somebody with no television experience whatsoever.
Well, judging by the recent performance, I reckon the latter is probably right. So probably someone who's actually marketed margarine is probably top of the list. Okay.
I don't think you can do that with a television channel.
No,
you can do it with audio and music.
No.
Because all the bits have been run by people who know what they're doing.
It may not make sense, but of course you can do it.
Well, the other thing is, by the way, Janice...
And it's not BBC One, remember, of course. But, I mean, the thing is, BBC One has got to have the reach to underpin the licence fee. Hmm. BBC Two is where you can play a bit.
Well, if you want to do what Steve says, though, which is inject some new personality into BBC Two, maybe that is what you want to do. Because if you've got all the bits are sort of there, but what you need is to sell it in a different way,
I know Janice. She's not a close friend, but I do know her.
Underestimate Janice Hadley.
Don't underestimate Janice. Yeah. No, she doesn't have a public persona herself, but I tell you what, she would give that channel a personality.
Yes, she would. I agree.
Hope it's not hers, but it would give us something like that. That's completely unfair.
See, you'll get
I'm going to get fired before I start.
He's insulted so many people already.
Listen, we should say a real triumph for Media Talk in other BBC news this week after the announcement that there's going to be a ban on all sponsorship of BBC-run events. Our listeners heard it here first, didn't they?
They did not, yes. Yes. Because we found the website, which had the commercial proposition offering mentions, number of mentions per minute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
This all, of course...
This was for Robinson's.
Came out of Robinson's and the Sports Personality of the Year.
And no filming required.
No, absolutely. Well, you can keep up to date with the race to replace Rowley and the rest of the moves and machinations at the BBC by heading to mediaguardian.co.uk/BBC. And we'll be talking more telly with Gareth McLean a little later on.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Time to switch to the wireless now. The latest set of Rajars were published this week, and the main headline was that the commercial stations have closed the gap on their BBC rivals. You don't often hear that, do you? It's not all good news in the commercial sector, though, especially for the employees of GCAP. It's been reported there'll be around 160 redundancies there as they prepare for their takeover by Global. Let's start with that story, Paul Robinson. Bit of a bloodbath there, isn't it?
Well, what's interesting is the commercial radio industry is shrinking in every way apart from its audience figures at the moment.
Well, it's only a momentary blip, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Business bonanza, isn't it?
the global cuts are...
What's that about, then? What do they do?
Well, they're basically taking out not only production staff, but all the back office functions. You know, Capital Radio and GWR and GCAP were a very big corporate organisation. Big corporate PR departments, you know, big interactive departments. All of those support functions are basically being hacked away. But they're also taking away a whole load of production staff across their major stations. And they're losing senior management, Ivor Etienne at Choice FM.
I was just going to say, Choice FM's Ivor Etienne, the programme director, he's leaving. So that's quite a big, you know, figure to get rid of.
It is. And Ivor, you know, comes from that music background. He used to work with me at Radio 1. In fact, he's a real advocate for that station. So I think the risk there is that station loses its personality and its distinct positioning in the market.
Well, what about the Rajars then? I mean, it's tempting to talk about the battle for the top spot in London, and it seems to just get shared between all the top three. You know, it's the turn of Dr. Fox to take the top spot in breakfast, if I can get that out. But it's much of a muchness there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for commercial radio, this is actually a chink of light, but it's not yet a recovery. So it's good news, but hey, let's wait two or three more quarters and see whether it sustains. As far as London's concerned, of course, the real top spot is actually the Today programme by miles.
Yeah.
You know, let's not forget that, followed by Radio 2. Dr. Fox is currently number one by a reasonably small margin. It could change to be Heart or Capital, who knows?
So we've mentioned before, but Chris Tarrant starts across the several GMG stations on Saturday. The interesting thing about this is how it's funded, isn't it? Is the funding by Nissan?
Yes, I mean, GMG Radio have not actually paid for Chris Tarrant. This is a deal between Paul Vaughan, Chris Tarrant's agent, and Nissan, who effectively get a lot of sponsorship on the show. GMG get the show free, and then they sell the advertising. And what they've cleverly done is networked it across a whole range of their stations nationally. So I think the good sign here is, for the first time, commercial radio in a long time have got a big name talent, someone who came through commercial radio, made his name on Capital with 17 years on The Breakfast Show, actually going up against Jonathan Ross for the first time.
I wonder,
a good move by them, I would say.
Do you think? I don't know. Isn't he yesterday's man?
Not really, no. Honestly, in the States,
Capital Radio's leftovers?
No, he's not Capital Radio's leftovers. Chris Tarrant is a really good communicator, a good broadcaster. He's great on radio. I would say now he's getting older, better on radio than TV. There's a lot of affection for him. The big issue, of course, remember, is Chris Tarrant wasn't a national radio star. He was a London radio star. So the people outside London, people in Newcastle or Manchester, they'll be hearing Chris Tarrant on the radio really for the first time, and that's the real test for him.
It's very London-centric of us to go on about him like that. But Steve, do you think it's a good move for and could signal a new way for commercial radio to fund big stars?
Well, I won't pretend to understand the economics of it precisely, but on the face of it, well, yes. I mean, I think Tarrant was an outstanding radio broadcaster. You know, this is just having listening to him in London And I think I, you know, as Paul says, you know, he's now known to the nation because of Millionaire and the other, and also some of the tabloids, if I expect. But anyway, but he'll find. I think he'll be good.
Well, we've got a bit of a clue as to what's going to be on the show because he's got his website is up and running, and there's a feature called Call Waiting. Do you fancy getting a call from Chris Tarrant out of the blue? Saturday staff shockers. Don't feel left out just because you have to work Saturdays. Champion the cause of Saturday workers. But my favourite is tenuous fish songs. Okay. Chris loves to fish. You see the link? Chris loves to fish, so send us your fish-related songs. Can you think of any fish-related songs?
Oh, let's talk about being put on the spot.
Well, there's Yellow Submarine, which is sort of an ocean.
It's not fish.
Well, it's oceans, isn't it? And didn't the video have lots of fish in it?
It did.
But I can't think of... It's
going to be a very short-run feature, I imagine. I
mean, you last very long, isn't it?
You make an interesting point, actually. The other thing is Tarrant's choosing all the music, and that is actually quite an interesting move, because commercial radio doesn't let you do that generally. So that's actually quite a brave move, too, and I think it'd be interesting to see what he comes up with.
Creatively... You know, as part of those reasons, I mean, this is well, as Paul says, it's unusual. Meanwhile, and again, I say this as a kind of an complete outsider to radio, commercial radio anyway, and that's, you know, you've got Charles Allen, who appears to be doing to commercial radio exactly what he did to commercial television, not a creative idea in sight, but lots of cost-cutting and merging in the background.
Well,
let's see. You've got me dangling on a string, chairman of the board. How will that do?
Hey, that's very good. Yes, it didn't take very long. Excellent stuff. Well, I think we should ask our listeners to post their fish-related songs on our blog, which will be a very exciting thing to read out.
You could have fishy-related songs, perhaps.
Sorry? Well, GMG-related. Well, we should declare an interest in that. We're
quite right.
We're owned by the Guardian Media Group,
exactly.
But we have nothing to do with GMG Radio. Let's leave all that there. Next up, it's Gareth McLean. And the great man is here. Hello, Gareth. How are
Hello,
you?
Hello. All right.
The panel are just they're digging into their biscuits.
It's gorgeous.
You know, they're Otis Spunkmaster. Spunkmeister.
They are.
That's the brand of them.
I know it is.
That's why they taste so smooth and creamy.
Sorry. They've got raisins.
This one's got chocolate chips in it.
Let's not take that analogy any further. We were trying to figure out, for the benefit of Chris Tarrant. For the benefit of Chris Tarrant, we were trying to think up some fish songs. Have you got any fish songs?
Fish songs.
Songs with fish in the title.
Total Eclipse of the Carp.
Ooh.
Never Mind the Pollock.
Yes.
I haven't a clue. I like this.
I think that's an album. How are you, Gareth?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm very excited about the Mosley Judgment.
It's very good. I've got
my favourite line from it.
We might have read it out.
Oh, really?
Go on, have a go.
You must have done, because it's surely obvious. Not like me to like something that's obvious. The claimant, for reasons best known to himself, enjoyed having his bottom shaved.
Yeah, we did that one.
We've done that one.
Paragraph 53. Yes.
I wonder why you two both alighted on that.
I naturally could not check from the DVD as it was not his face on display. I thought it was funny, the judge in the Mosley case, because normally it's high court judges that are into all that malarkey, isn't it?
Filthiness.
So he was probably a bit like jealous.
He did seem to have an intimate knowledge of the BDSM scene.
BDSM.
Bondage, domination. What is it? Submission and... Masochism.
Marshmallows. I don't know. I have no knowledge of that.
We're supposed to be talking television.
Sorry, yeah. Well, there's nothing going on. Well, Harley Street's still going on. Now, Kickers is still going on, losing viewers with every passing week. I was looking at the casting for Law & Order UK.
Is it going to be a Law & Order UK?
Yeah. They announced it. It's like a co-production between Kudos and NBC or Dick Wolf or whoever.
And who's going to be on it?
Well, it's a bit random. Jeremy Bamber from Battlestar Galactica.
Well, that's, yes, okay.
Who's going to be partnered with Bradley Walsh from Coronation Street.
I see.
They're the police.
And
Free Magiman's the kind of lawyer.
That is all a bit random. but you mentioned Bradley Walsh, because I thought you were going to say Bradley Whitford.
Oh, yeah, Bernard.
Hasn't he put on a lot of weight?
Well, he's got older.
Well, he has got quite, you know, since he left the West Wing. So what's that, Steve?
I had an erotic dream about him, and I've never really had thoughts for him like that when I've been awake, but I had a very vivid dream about him once.
What, Bradley Whitford?
Yeah. Oh,
I think we'll moving on. Move on from that
And
one.
John Hurt and Michelle Ryan have joined the cast of Merlin.
How's your blog going?
It's going all right. This week I've written about lesbians.
Yeah, I noticed that. And the lack of them.
And the lack of them on television.
Since Beth Jordash.
Yes.
Well, the fact that we mentioned Beth Jordash.
Exactly, my point, precisely. But I'm off to Devon today. I'm going to a wedding.
Okay.
Not mine.
So no...
Devon knows how they make those so creamy.
Oh, dear. That's back to Otis Spunkmeister.
Do you know what?
Biscuits.
I wouldn't eat those because they've got sultanas or something in them. And you never know it's not a blue bottle.
That's true. But they're very juicy and lovely.
We did say that we were going to talk about Dragon's Den earlier on.
I'm sort of bored.
Have
of
you
that.
Been watching Dragon's Den?
Well, it was all right, but you know what I mean? It's suffering from, and I suppose it's the same with all the shows, the observer effect.
Oh, okay.
The act of filming it alters the thing. So now it's just turned into that. Here's some stupid ideas, well, just for television, rather than these are quite interesting businessy things.
The Guardian effect is surely being exposed to The Wire, which The Guardian must have written about constantly.
The same number of articles for the number of viewers who watched it.
Well, this is the thing, 34,000. We might as well just posted all the articles to each one of them.
They probably did, didn't they?
Why is it, can we just briefly talk about The Wire, why is it that it gets so much column inches and so few viewers?
Well, I think because it's quite complicated. And, well, it's FX. I know FX has a presence and it's sort of developing as a brand, and that's where Dexter's on, and I like Dexter. But I think it's just not for some people. And I think, you know, the kind of sprawling, epic, huge brilliance of it does put some people off.
Okay.
Because some people don't want something really hard to concentrate on when they get in. They don't want, like, the inanity of Bone Kickers, but neither do they want that kind of hardcore, in-depth thing. It's all right for us who watch TV for a living, do you know what I mean? But when you come home from a hard day at work, not that I've ever had a hard day at work. But
there's no excuse for me watching Doc Martin, though, is there, really?
Oh, no, but the countryside's
quite good, Doc Martin.
I quite like Doc Martin.
It's all right.
I think
it's
yeah. It's nicer than Kingdom.
It's better than Kingdom? I don't know. Oh, no, Paul Robinson. Oh. You're still young at heart, you see.
You see, there's no spaceships in
young
it.
Young at heart. Is that an EITV1 drama?
That means I'm really quite old, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Sorry about that. Right, it's okay. I think we're going to wrap that up there. Anything else to say,
no.
Gareth?
No, thank you. Oh, well, no, I just want to point out my favourite headline of the week, which is from the magazine Real People. My orgasm gave me a stroke. Oh. But surely my stroke gave me an orgasm.
It went out happy anyway.
On that note...
That's a happy finish.
It certainly is. May I point you to our blog on Organ Grinder for
not with his fingers.
And for links to everything we've discussed this week. Post your feedback there or on our Facebook wall. Thank you very much to Paul Robinson, Steve Hewlett and Gareth McLean. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.